welcome to the Beef Bits podcast. I'm Jeff Limcooler, extension professor at the University of Kentucky, and I'll be your host for the Beef Bits podcast. I'll be joined by colleagues and other guests to share general beef cattle management and production tips. I hope you enjoy the show, and be sure to provide us with feedback on whichever platform you might be listening with. Be sure to hit that subscribe button and give us your feedback on what you think about the content that we're sharing. Now let's get on with today's show. Welcome to another episode of the Beef Bits podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Limcooler, and today I'm joined by my great colleague, Dr. Jimmy Henning. Dr. Henning is a forage specialist here at the University of Kentucky. Jimmy, welcome.
Thank you, Jeff.
So today I thought maybe you and I could kind of discuss some ongoing field work that you've been doing with regards to balage, which is really nothing new, but it is kind of new.
Yes. Our balage is round bale silage. And, I am a forage specialist here at UK and been at UK since, as I tell my students, the 1900s.
But spent a little time in another big forage state as well, right?
I did. I mean, I've learned a chunk at the University of Missouri for 4 years and really appreciate my time there. We got into this. You and I had a discussion. It was probably 2017. Our better producers were sending balage samples off to get a fermentation panel done, which is to tell us how well did it ferment, what's the lactic acid, what's the pH, and those sorts of things. And the numbers were coming back disappointingly low. And I stood in your office and I said, Jeff, we got to figure this out because we've got, you can read all over the place that unless we get to a pH of 4.5 and a lactic acid of 3%, that, all manner of bad things will be caused, like male pattern baldness and,
Speaking from experience, huh?
Exactly right. Yeah, exactly. So we started on down this path of having producers send in samples so we could begin to try to figure out, okay, so why are we seeing this? I won't say poor fermentation, but just less than complete. And what does it mean? Because these good producers were feeding this material all day long and having no troubles. So it was confusing to me. And so we just took a deep dive and started taking a look.
So maybe we should start there with discussing the difference between halage and balage. So maybe give us a kind of, in your own words, the differentiation between those two.
A lot of times they're equated to be the same. I mean, we will do that if we're not careful. But halage really is a chopped product that is put in like an upright silo or a bag. And that's a totally different fermentation scenario than, say, our long, wet forage that we roll up into a bale of well, we call it hay, but it's too wet to be hay, and then wrap plastic around it so that becomes a little silo, but it's not chopped. And so that's where the initial confusion came, at least in my mind, and I think in the minds of others, is the parameters that you would expect to see for good halage are going to be different. Well, they're easier to it's easier to make good, have good fermentation when you're chopping material and you got all that mixing of the fluids and everything is kind of all together, than when we've got long forage and you've got the sugars and the fermentable carbohydrates are kind of locked up in cells. So halage is the chopped material. Balage will just, for simplicity's sake, is long material, both of them made anaerobic by some means so that they ferment.
And so for that fermentation to occur, what has to take place?
We have got to exclude air. That happens in a silo. the packing of it, you know, and it's sealed and it'll exclude air. Same thing with a long plastic tube. In our bales, because we've got this long forage, we start that process by squeezing it as hard as we can when we make a bale of hay to squeeze out as much air as we can. Then we will wrap it with, the research will say that we can get by with four layers of this stretch wrap UV resistant plastic, but because of, you know, stems both outside the bale and inside the bale, we use six plus layers to make sure that we get a good seal, and then that becomes anaerobic over the space of probably a few hours to a day.
Yeah, because we are talking about a microbial fermentation, correct?
That is right. And anaerobic fermentation. Unlike, you know, the fermentation that we're very aware of in Kentucky that happens, you know, in distilleries, right? This is going to be fermentation without outside of the presence of oxygen.
And so the differentiation that you mentioned with regards to the haylage, where it's chopped and you have access or more of the liquid and sugar accessible by those microbes to help them quickly ferment that, where you mentioned in the baleage, it's locked up in the cells. Does all of the sugars then really get fermented? And so maybe explain that role of having a bale versus a pile of chopped hay.
You know, that's a really good point. When we measure the fermentation, you know, do a quality test of material that has been fermented, both haylage and baleage, you're going to find that more of the carbohydrates, the soluble carbs, are chewed up and changed into the organic acids that we need to preserve it in haylage. In baleage, we wind up with, I guess you would say, an incomplete fermentation. So we will often see, you know, fairly, I would say high, but higher levels of fermentable carbs in a round bale silage bale, because those the bacteria is on the outside of the plant cell of the leaf, you know, if you think of it that way, and then the sugars are on the inside. Now, when you make hay, you do macerate the material to some degree, and we get a mixing of cell contents, and the cells break and things like that, but it's it just winds up being incomplete.
So that's a kind of a good maybe lead in then to some of the work you were doing in some of your studies, looking at this incomplete fermentation in maybe what our expected lower pH. You know, we were hoping to see something, like you said, in the fours, upper fours. So tell us a little bit about some of the work that you've been doing in regards to monitoring baleage and quality of fermentation.
Sure will. We started, and I guess the real big push came when our ag program leader here, Dr. Craig Wood, funded a small project, and the agents in about six counties helped us gather these samples, send them off. We would, and I was present for most of the sampling, I think all of it, we would go to the site. And we would sample these bales, and we would also, after a bit of time, after we had been doing this a little bit, we started collecting information about equipment too, and time of how long the, you know, other things associated with the production of that baleage. But we would, observe the site, look at the plastic, look at the bales, sample the bales. We would patch those bales, you know, patch that plastic that we punctured with the appropriate tape, the UV resistant stick tape that's made for that product, and then we would send that off for both a quality test and a fermentation panel to see, to develop a database where we felt pretty confident about, does it look good in the bale? Is the bale standing up and upright? There are some things that we will notice whenever we have some of the negative effects of fermentation. So we're making observations there. And Now, while we didn't track every producer's experience with feeding this material, we do know that nobody came back to us and said this material didn't feed well.
That's a good point. So when you took those samples and ran them through analysis at a commercial laboratory, what were some of the components that you were really looking at and focusing in on?
Well, to be honest, Jeff, I really had to go to school. To learn what components to look at. Now, the biggies are the pH. I mean, when we ensile forage, the pH will drop from somewhere in the sixes or almost neutral into, if you can, into the, like you said, the upper fours. Other things that you will measure we were new to look for included the amount of lactic acid, which is one of the very desirable end products of fermentation in a round build of silage. The things that we didn't want and we knew we wanted to look at were the butyric acid production. And butyric acid production is associated with very wet haylage or baleage and also clostridial, or we call it secondary fermentation. And that's an indication that something negative has gone on. After a bit of time and we began to look at some things, we begin to pick up on parameters like how much of the nitrogen is present as ammonia. That's also an indication that you've got clostridial fermentation. And then we were, on some cases, we would focus in on the ash content too, because clostridial bacteria is introduced into bales from mainly from soil particles.
Yeah, so they're soil-borne they're basically soil-borne organisms, I guess. And so we talk about this pH drop and this clostridial fermentation. Why should we care?
Yeah. Well, of course, clostridial botulinum makes the botulism toxin and kills things graveyard dead. That's the biggie, you know. And I think that's the fear that people have when they're just thinking about baleage, or, you know, you talk about it at McDonald's or at the coffee shop, you know. Oh, well, you heard about so-and-so and they killed, you know, 25 head and things like that. And it happens.
It does.
But there are, you know, many different strains and many different, anti-quality type products produced by clostridial bacteria. And some that just cause intake problems, some that cause some digestive upsets and those sorts of things. But the butyric acid is that signal to us that hey, we've got some of that going on.
And it tends to, you mentioned the palatability, you know, the botulism is a big concern.
Yeah.
We also tend to think of that being more at a greater risk if there's a dead animal that gets into a bale, like a rabbit or something like that.
That's right.
But the putrid smell from a butyric fermentation that affects intake is just, I mean, that's our potentially bigger issue, right?
Yes. And when we were on site and testing round bales of silage, before we got the fermentation panel back, I could tell you which groups of baleage were going to have butyric, because it is a noticeable smell.
Can you describe that?
Well, I'll go back to the compounds. The two compounds that are produced are called putrescine and cadaverine, and so from our word putrid and cadaver, so it's something. It smells like something dead.
Yeah,
it's pretty potent.
So then, if we go through and you're looking at these on your forage fermentation profile analysis, this is not something standard that people are going to get with a forage quality analysis, correct?
That is right. We had to ask for two different kinds of tests, at least at the lab we use. One was the quality test that tells us the protein, the fiber, the energy, and to some extent the minerals and so on. And then we had to ask in a separate test, the It's called a fermentation panel. This particular lab, different labs call it different things, and they measure different things.
And so then you get those back. What kind of did you have in your mind some preconceived benchmark targets or?
You know, besides the pH and the lactic acid of 3%, pH at around 5 or below and lactic acid of 3%, I really, I was kind of going to school. I was looking at those numbers, trying to be, just plot them out and see, okay, so what about this bale? What's correlated to this lactic acid content? And it was remarkable how much of the variation in lactic acid content was caused by the moisture content in that bale. I mean, it was like 80 or 90% of the variation that we found was due to moisture.
Okay, so there's a relationship between lactic acid, which is, for lack of better words, our pickling agent in the forge.
Yep.
And moisture content. So Let's elaborate a little more on that. Which way does that go? Because you said high moisture leads to more clostridial fermentation, which could be bad, but let's dive into that a little more.
Yeah. Well, we did dive into that. And because if you look at the extension literature, it says we can make baleage with a moisture content from 40 to 60, which is pretty broad. But the work we did found that there was not a lot of fermentation that went on in a bale if the moisture content was between 40 and 50. It would be maybe a 1% lactic acid production. And then as we got to 55 to 60, then we're beginning to approach on a more regular basis that 3% lactic acid. So it was apparent that, well, it's very apparent that the 3% lactic acid was going to come from those nearly 60% moisture bales.
Interesting. So if we think about a fermentation process that requires microbes to come into contact with soluble carbohydrates to be able to ferment them, it kind of makes some sense that we've got to have some moisture in the forge to be able to allow access for the bacteria to get to those water-soluble carbohydrates.
It does. And there's one other factor that you brought up earlier, and I wanted to go back over it now. You've got to have a forage that's got soluble carbs to ferment. And if we're really, really mature, like we can get some very mature wheat, for example, then, first of all, that bale is hard to compress and squeeze all the oxygen out. We trap a lot. And you don't have as much of the soluble carbs to ferment, and you wind up with a poor fermentation due to lack of carbs, too.
So do you have a rule of thumb, then, on maturity of forages for thinking about putting into baleage versus, say, haylage?
Yes. And it would be much the same as some of our optimum ranges for hay, in that boot to early head for grasses and first flower for legumes. We're just trying. We know that. Well, we get the yield from the stems in wheat, and the wheat heads will have some carbs in them. But we want to harvest those small grains when there's still a lot of green leaf material, not when we've let the head mature and it's brown stem. That's very difficult to ferment.
At that point, you're probably better just making dry hay, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so on maturity, are there some signals that we can look at on that forage quality report to give us an idea? I mean, are we looking at certain parameters like protein or ash content? What are you looking for to help us get an idea on immature or mature?
You know, for me, I go right to the fiber numbers, and I particularly go to the ADF number, the acid detergent fiber, which, as you know, is we call that the somewhat indigestible portion of the fiber. And the closer that, we have targets that we're looking for, the closer that number is to 30, for grasses, that's pretty hard to get to. But for well-managed and, you know, early maturity grasses and legumes, an ADF of 35 or below is going to signal some pretty high quality material. The other fiber number, neutral detergent fiber, also helps us because we can, if that number gets very, if it, for grasses, it should be, the highest stuff is about 50% neutral detergent fiber. Legumes can drop into the 40s. But if we're getting into the 60, 65, and 70% NDF, now NDF is the total fiber in the plant, so it's in, it's pretty intuitive that if it's, you got 70% fiber, that means you've got only 30% of the good stuff, if you want to look at it that way. And that limits fermentation, limits intake, limits performance.
Yeah, so we can, I think that's important because there are times that I have seen some fermentation reports that I look at the quality and I see it's got that low ADF in the 30s, the NDF is not too far off. The moisture content is okay, but maybe a little on the drier side. And so then we start looking at that pH did not drop and the lactic acid is not there. So it wasn't the fact that the quality in it was too mature. It probably was what you saw was this moisture effect.
Absolutely right. You know, and once we saw that and realized that if people do what we say, which means make baleage from 40 to 60%, that they're going to have some of this pH in the not very low, say 5, 5.5 or above, and lactic acid of 1%. The question that I had was, okay, so what? Does it really mean that this is a problem? Can we feed this stuff? And so, you know, we struggled, or at least I struggled, trying to answer that question when you get this incomplete fermentation indication on a report. And because the next question that comes is, well, can I feed it?
Exactly. And then when you've got a couple hundred bales of material, you know, from our perspective at the time, is it's going to be a risk, right?
I mean, right. And so I guess I just on a personal level, I feel like we owe a producer a better answer than that. And so what I did and what you probably knew already, Jeff, from working more directly with it, but you go back into the literature and really this idea, this result that we saw where baleage, round bale silage, didn't ensile as well is not a new thing. Right. But I think when some of our extension materials get put together or when, you know, what we say and what people hear are two different things, then they begin to think, oh, if I don't have it well fermented, then I'm going to have listeriosis, botulism, all sorts of bad things. When in fact, it's not an unusual outcome at all for a bale of round bale silage to not completely ensile. Then you got to say, okay, so. What makes it okay to feed if it's really not well preserved due to fermentation?
That's a good point. And yesterday I was on a farm and we were discussing his baleage and it was second and third cutting. And he just simply said, he goes, it's not keeping. It's not, when I set it out, it's not keeping as well. So what factors in the fermentation are contributing to that?
That's a really good question. The thing that keeps that baleage from going bad in the bale, you know, while we're waiting to feed it, is the fact that that plastic is sealed and you've got no oxygen getting in. When we take that out, the fact that we don't have those really high levels of lactic acid and particularly acetic acid at that point, which is another good outcome of fermentation, then that bale becomes like a bale of wet hay that will do the things that wet hay does in a bale, and that's mold and heat. If the temperatures are warm and it doesn't get eaten very quickly.
Right, and you look, we've had a relatively warm fall, and we had a relatively dry summer, and he said, I was cutting it in the morning and baling in the afternoon, and it was still too dry. And that's what I found when I just reached my hand in and pulled a little out. Yeah. I could smell some good fermentation, but It looked like typical dry hay. It didn't have any off color, which we sometimes see when it goes through a fermentation.
Yeah.
And it was just dry.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We get a secondary fermentation and an aerobic fermentation then, because it gets exposed to oxygen, and we get concerned about then what, listeriosis and listeria growth.
It, you know, the real important thing there is that it you eat it as fast as you can. It's also points up the advantage of individually wrapped bales versus those that we have in a big inline tube or inline row of wrapped bales. Because once you open that inline row of bales, that end bale is, and to some extent, some of those ones that will back into the roll will be exposed to air. And so we really rely on the cold temperatures of winter to keep that from heating and molding very quickly.
And I think general rule of thumb has, you know, typically been that you need a bale to disappear in so many days. And
that's right.
In a good fermentation, we may say 5 to 7 days. In a product that didn't ferment very well, that, and in warm temperatures like we've been seeing, that window is drastically shortened.
And you know, and we probably can't say, you know, within to the hour what that safe period is, but a couple of days it ought to be gone.
Right.
And you can judge. And so a lot of this, you know, we don't rely on a lab analysis. A lot of this you can go out and look and see. If I've got a if the bale looks bad, it probably is bad. And now that's not very scientific at all, but in this case there's a lot of truth to that with baleage in particular.
That's a good point. And there is, it's not that maybe they wouldn't want to feed it, but in a year where we've had really low yield in first cutting hay, relatively dry weather the rest of the summer, and hay availability is short, there is this great temptation or desire to feed what we have and hope that, oh, it looks a little off, but it's probably okay.
Right. Yeah. And that's a tough call to make, as you know. But yeah, it is a challenge. Go ahead.
So let's back up then, thinking about some of your work and just as a quick summary, are you making different recommendations now with regards to moisture when it comes to putting up baleage?
I would say yes. In my optimum, the best is to, as best you can, to bale at 60% moisture. And that gives you the fermentation you want. That's assuming, you know, cutting it at a reasonably immature stage of maturity so it will ferment. So we want that on the wetter side. And we've had producers that have become more successful at making baleage, quite a bit more successful, by baling wetter. Now, as you and I both know, measuring moisture in the field is a challenge. And so then the next thing you get into, the subject you get into is how to estimate the moisture in the field, and that is a challenge.
That's where I was hoping you would go, because we have some opportunities to look, or maybe some tools to look at that moisture, but it varies a lot from where you go in the windrow.
Yes. I mean, I've done it every way you can, and I've done it poorly every way you can. the easiest way to get a better look at a moisture sample is to take a sample and really physically dry it. I mean, we've got commercial little heating units, you know, with a fan and put a chopped forage up on top and weigh it wet and weigh it dry. And man, that'll get you the number, but it's only that little bit of forage, and it takes you about 2 or 3 hours to get that done. You can do the same thing with a microwave as your heat source. The a lot of us, well, and then you can, you, there are windrow testers. There are commercially available, promoted windrow testers for balage. And you have to be careful that which one you're talking about, because some of them are intended only for the moisture ranges that are in the lower end of the scale, like 40% down. But you want to find one that's promoted to handle the wetter material. And, you know, those involve stuffing a bunch of forage into a bucket, pressing down with a fairly tight and uniform amount of pressure, and then taking a reading. And we've worked with that product, at least one of them, with, I would say, disappointing results. It seems to vary, and we have not done the exhaustive studies to know why it varies, but it seems to vary with the size of the stems. The stemmier, like a Pearl Millet, a Sorghum Sudan forage, we miss it a mile. You know, it will appear drier than it really is. The more fine leafy that material is, then we get closer. Now it measures in the right direction. I mean, wetter stuff is going to give you a higher number, drier stuff at a lower number, but it doesn't let you go out there and determine with a high degree of accuracy that I'm at 60% moisture. Then then the other kind is a kind where you actually make a bale and probe it, and it has some challenges too. And I put myself in the position of what would I do if I was a farm manager. I would do a lot of all that kind of testing until I began to understand that relationship between what the environment is outside, windy, sunny, warm, cool, wet, dry, whatever, and then the drying rate of certain forage crops. And over time, I think people get really, really good at knowing that. You can get feedback, too, from equipment. If you are really wet, then your equipment will begin to tell you that you've got a problem, or it's in that higher end of the range. And balers do come with moisture sensors in them too. And we haven't really tried to track that number, you know, over time. But and I tend to think that might be a very useful number to watch in a baler. But by that time, you've got to commit to be in the field with the equipment to go. And once you start baling, you know, you got a limited amount of time before that needs to be in a plastic, inside the plastic.
Yeah, that's a good point. And so you mentioned, we talked about this anaerobic process and the need to wrap that, and then you just mentioned the time. So what is the ideal time, or what is the maybe window of time from when a bale is made to when it gets wrapped in that 4 to 6 layers of plastic?
We would typically say bale what you can wrap in a day, the same day. We have done the temperature profiles and know that the temperature doesn't really start going up appreciably until 24 hours. So if you were to finish baling late tonight and you could wrap before, get it done before noon tomorrow, then we would be comfortable that you're within that window. Beyond 24 hours, then we begin to get a fair amount of heating in the bales, depending on the ambient temperature and a bunch of other things.
And that's important because you've got an aerobic fermentation starting to chew up some of your carbohydrates that you want to be chewed up by anaerobic bacteria for preservation.
That's exactly right. And the more, yes, that's exactly right.
So what about wrapping these bales? And, you know, there's always, seems like you get into one of these long line wrappers and you get to a spot and there's a seam because maybe the bales didn't line up right or we're going maybe not in a straight row. Talk to us a little bit about plastic management.
That's a really good point. And I was reviewing some of our work before this podcast, and I was reminded of a situation where we had a kind of a perfect storm of plastic that was not the highest in quality, both in integrity of the plastic and the strength and the amount of the adhesive that's on the underside that makes it stick to each other, and some very irregularly shaped bales for an inline baler. It was a triple perfect storm in that this was really high quality material. So that these bales, it's like trying to wrap baseballs, you know, a row of baseballs. And at the junction, the plastic just could not hold on. And so it wound up breaking at every junction between those bales. And we had, it's the only time I've ever seen some of the off-color mold, I mean the green mold. We do see some surface white mold at those junctions between those two round bales and those inline wrapped material, and that's from a little oxygen seeping in those the bales are not quite the same height, and that plastic doesn't seal itself. But when you see green, red, blue color molds, that typically means something really bad is going on, and that bale needs to go to the compost bin.
Yeah, and so that's a huge thing when we start looking at the weather is turning. It looks like rain may be coming, and so I'm going to try to push the baler a little bit faster, and you tend to see things get maybe a little bit, they're not all the same size, all the same weight per se.
Yeah.
And that becomes a challenge.
It really does. And you will find in the recommendations that, you know, to slow down at the junctions between bales, but in the real world and the pressure of wrapping a couple hundred bales, people don't slow down. The people who do it well probably don't have these very misshapen bales anyway, but they will put a lot more plastic than even six layers.
Yeah.
And that's cheap insurance. But some of the toughest calls that I think I'm asked to make is you go to a farm and you look at a bale, and then you're trying to assess the degree of moldiness. And if it's just on the surface and you feel like it smells good, it looks good, inside the bale looks good, the risk is low with feeding problems. But I was on one purebred operation one time, and you got these very expensive bred heifers over here, and they bring out this round bale of silage, and it was pretty apparent that it never did seal. It was moldy throughout. And I said, no, you can't feed that at all. Not to those animals, you know. But that was one of the, it's a bale by bale call sometimes when you're looking at mold.
Yeah, that's a good point. The other thing I think we haven't really touched on with regards to that is the differences in maybe pH drop and or buffering capacity of legume versus a grass.
Boy, you know, that was also something that helped me sleep at night when you helped me find that article from that work done by Muck in Wisconsin, where, you know, they clearly showed that the endpoint pH that we need in round bale silage in order to inhibit Clostridium chain is different with both moisture content and the legume content, because legumes buffer the acid production more, and it takes more acid to drop the pH. Then you, for a properly fermented bale, you can have a higher level of pH if it's all legume than if it's all grass. And it was a very much of an aha moment.
Yeah, because we promote the use of interseeding legumes into our grass hay stands, and so you're going to have varying amounts of red clover, white clover maybe in those. And so we may expect a little different fermentation profile.
Yes. And you know, at the end of the day, there are a lot of moving parts. But one of the things that is just a lead pipe cinch is when you make balage, you got to keep the plastic sealed. And that is, when that doesn't happen, there are not too many other good things that are going to happen after that.
Good point. I seen a video somebody posted the other day of an individually wrapped large square bale, and they had mouse holes in it, and they said, well, let's see how much of the bale is bad. And they went to cut the plastic, and on the one side about 2/3 of it was bad. On the other side, it was completely moldy and dark and miscolored. So you're right. We need to keep those things sealed.
Yes. We, on one of the very few botulism cases I have worked, it was there were a couple of problems that led to it, one of which was he had an incredible amount of dirt that he had raked into those bales. But the other was that they had a big gash that we found out about after the fact. I didn't go on site. I was doing this, you know, remote, and looking at hay tests or fermentation analyses. And it wasn't until the farmer said, well, I didn't really get into problems until I got to that section of that inline tube where there was a big gash in the plastic. And, you know, note to self, always go look at these bales.
Yeah.
But the plastic integrity, we just can't stress enough how important that is to be able to lower your risk of ever having a problem.
So before we wrap up, plastic integrity, can it be affected by the material that's used to make a bale, to wrap it, to tie it?
Yes, a good point. The sisal, the oil-treated twine, has in the past degraded that UV protective plastic. And so if you're going to use twine on a bale, then don't use the oil type. There are plastic, you know, now we have a lot of plastic twine, that's fine. But the oil-treated stuff, we've had real problems with that. Net wrap, no problem. No problem.
And then as we think through a few of these other kind of general recommendations, maybe we don't know this, but what are your thoughts on an inoculant versus not an inoculant if we have subpar fermentation risks and some of those things?
You know, it's an area that you well know that we need to do a lot more work in, but we have got at least some really good work done actually by a man who's now a farmer in northern Kentucky, where in some like late cutoff fescue after frost, you know, which plenty of sugars in that material. Without an inoculum, it didn't ferment at all. With an inoculum, it was perfect. So when we have like low temperatures and those low temperatures sometimes knock down the numbers of fermenting bacteria. Sometimes the inoculation will overcome to some degree a lower level of carbs, not no carbs, but it will help. It will help kickstart that fermentation process, and we certainly would recommend it anytime we can. A midsummer cutting of things with good leafy material is probably not going to respond, but some of these early spring, late fall cuttings, if I can get it on there, it's a good insurance and not very expensive to do.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Henning, we are pushing up almost on our time limit, but are there some other things that maybe you'd like to discuss or share with regards to baleage or some of the work that you've done?
You know, I guess one of the things that we've done is we've expanded our work to move into more states to try to see, you know, do we see a difference if we get further south in particular? And the reassuring thing is we see the very, very same pattern of that moisture content affecting bale pH and lactic acid content in Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, Tennessee, as we see right here. And we're going to make that a point at the upcoming AFGC meetings down in Mobile, Alabama.
Excellent. So if people want to learn a little bit more about some of that work, they would be a good trip and a very educational opportunity to go to the American Forage and Grassland Council's meeting down there in Alabama.
Exactly.
It's always a good mix of academic and producer-oriented research and discussion, as I recall.
It is really good. It helps both ways. I think the producers benefit, but I think we do too in hearing what's really going on in the field.
Yeah. So as you kind of sit here and are thinking spring's going to be around the corner. We're in November already, and folks are thinking about bailage. I had this question the other night at a county meeting. Why would I consider bailage from a quality standpoint? In other words, if I, yeah. And he actually asked, if I took a field and I cut it in half, what's the difference in quality between bailage versus the dry hay?
You know, that is a really good question. And you know, it's really, really, really difficult to answer that exactly. But because we can cut more nearly on time, and we're not going to shatter leaves with bailage, then we tend to have higher quality numbers with bailage than we do with making hay. Now, that said, you know, bailage has needs more equipment and another process and probably a little more labor. You know, economically speaking, the economists say make hay if you can and bailage if you can't. And the challenge, I think, with that is you kind of have to be ready to make bailage. You can't just switch. Most people can't switch just because they want to. They've got to prepare for one or the other.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned it, but we need to stress it, that bailage gives you a shorter window of time that you need to yeah. cut it and bale it in the spring at that ideal maturity for best quality and yield, where Mother Nature here, we have a lot of precipitation, and then we have to wait for that window of 4 or 5 days. And instead of cutting it mid-May, now we're back to the first week in June, and that's where the improvement in quality, in my opinion, comes from.
Yeah, you can cut on time, no yeah. question, and avoid rain damage. There is no question.
Yeah, excellent. Any other closing thoughts before I let you off the hook here?
I think this has been great. I appreciate the chance to visit about bailage, and it's been an interesting ride, and think producers are grateful for ground truthing a little bit of the stuff that we recommend.
Well, Dr. Henning, before I let you go, I know you've done a lot of work in this area, and you've put out a lot of good information. If people wanted to find additional resources or information about bailage and making bailage, where would you send them to go look for some additional resources?
I'll tell you, the first place I would go, have them go, is to go to their internet search window and type in UKY forage. And that'll take you to our site. And there's a hay and storage icon. And that's where the haylage material is. And that would be a great place to start. There's a forage YouTube channel link on that site, and you can go into that and find probably more than you want to listen to about making good round bale silage.
Fantastic. And if anyone needs additional resources, they can always go to their local county extension office and visit with their agent to get additional resources. And those are accessible to anybody on the internet as well. But it's always good to discuss some things, particularly when you got special situations or different forages and that, to think about, what's this going to perform like?
Yes.
With that, Dr. Henning, I want to thank you again for joining us on this episode of the Beef Bits podcast. I think we have covered a lot of ground in this short period of time.
Yes, we have.
And I think a lot of people are going to find a lot of good information from this. So thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this session of the Beef Bits podcast. I hope you found today's episode informative and that it added to your knowledge of beef cattle management. Be sure to subscribe to be notified when the next episode is released. And if you haven't listened to the previous sessions, be sure to go check them out. For more information on beef cattle management tips, stop in and see your local county extension agent. If you have questions, you can also send them to us, and we'll be happy to reply as soon as we can. Take care, and we look forward to seeing you in the future.